And so there is a halo of having built fintech systems in India, which will actually spur adoption in global
markets. This infra of enabling merchants and platforms and SME exporters to accept global payments is a big pain point among all the people we speak to.
Right, if not for these fintech infra companies, would these consumer companies would have it on their top 5 priorities to launch FS? Maybe, maybe not.
Hi everyone, welcome to Matrix Moments. We have here the fintech team at Matrix Partners, Vikram, Anand and Anish. Vikram, you guys most of you would already know, he's been investing for over a decade and MD at Matrix Partners. I have been investing in fintech startups for a couple of years now. Prior to this, I have spent a decade in financial services doing banking, private equity, traditional finance, and now investing in fintechs. Anish?
Yeah, hi guys. I also work with the fintech team here at Matrix. Been investing with the fund for close to 2.5 years, involved with a bunch of portfolio companies like Deserve, Otto, Jodo and Nakat. Look forward to the discussion today.
Yeah. So today we wanted to start an open discussion on bank tech and fintech infra. We have been spending some time speaking to experts in the banking and fintech domain to understand what are the emerging trends in the fintech infra space. Before we even start the discussion, Vikram, wanted to ask you, we have been investing in the domain, in the fintech domain for 10 plus years now. We have backed early champion companies in neobanking, lending, wealth. Why haven't we taken enough bets in fintech infra? There's a joke which goes around that we haven't taken a bet because either it's boring or sometimes even profitable. What's your take?
So for our listeners, this is what our fintech meetings look like, where the two of them push me on my mistakes. And this is sort of one of them, where we have, this is a sector that we should have invested a lot more in. And, you know, I keep telling these guys that whenever there's a gold rush, the people who are selling picks and shovels and jeans, they make a lot of money. And that's the same thing that's happened with the fintech gold rush, where both fintechs as well as banks have spent a lot on technology, and therefore some companies have gotten built, the likes of M2P, Zeta, to name a few, and there's a bunch of others who have gotten created in that space. So I think we should have done more to invest in that phase one of bank tech in this bank tech, fintech infra in this country. We did invest in Credit Vidya, which was acquired by Cred, great investment and journey with Avi, Abhishek, as well as Razorpay, which I would argue has built some of the backbone infra across the ecosystem. I think I'll talk about a few things that held us back. And I think some of those things have changed today. So the few things that held us back, the number one was, when you looked around globally, the biggest value was in this connectivity tissue between fintechs, banks, and how they were operating together and so on. And here, a lot of that was built by the India stack. So you have to give credit where it's due to, you know, Nandan, Sharad, Pramod, and the entire team at India stack. They built all of this as a public good. And honestly, the fintech ecosystem wouldn't be where it is today if they hadn't done that for us. But on the flip side, that meant a lot of the easy pickings on this bank tech space weren't available here. And so a lot of that value was essentially captured as a public good, and likely necessary in a country like ours because we want to drive financial services penetration. Then there were all the smaller things, which was, you know, will Indian companies pay for SaaS? Will, you know, what's the sales cycle and so on? Those are sort of minor considerations, but those are some of the things that sort of held us back. We definitely don't want to miss out on this next wave of bank tech that gets created. So that's what this podcast is about. I think Anand set it up as a brainstorm. We actually don't have the answers, but we have a few interesting hypotheses. But please try to send us feedback, what you agree with, what you don't agree with, and it'll really help us refine our point of view.
So Vikram, what has changed? We've had this BaaS thesis for some time now. We've seen the first-hand experience of some of our portfolio companies take a year or two to launch, do the integrations one-on-one. We understand how some of this works with banks. But what has changed now?
So the number one thing that has changed, I think, is every large bank and most small banks have a CDO. That means someone's life depends on it, on how they are engaging digitally with their accounts, with their users, but also with the other fintechs. So there's somebody who's like charter and life depends on this. So that's the number one thing that's changed. And I think they've all made their early mistakes. They've all, you know, tried something that didn't work and so on. And they've also figured out the process internally on how to adopt tech. One of the barriers was, how does risk and compliance actually work? There were lots of different influencers on that decision. And some of that has also been ironed out. And, you know, CDOs have a, you know, pride of position in that org where they are also able to implement this, and they have figured it out. So that's one. Second, I think both banks and fintechs have realized that partnership and in some ways, not even cooptation, it's actually cooperation, is the only way that they actually increase the pie for each other. And as long as that pie is growing, there is enough room for everyone. I think that's the second thing that has changed. And for the banks, I think fintech revenue pools have become significant. I saw multiple analyst presentations this quarter, which actually showcased the fintech partnerships that they've had. You can see that in the Axis Bank presentation. You can see that in the federal presentation and so on. So it has actually become important enough that they are showcasing this to the market and their partnerships to the market. And on the fintech side, I think they realize they have to make big investments in the tech stack, which is partly for their own good. I can call out two of our portfolio companies. One is OneCard, which built the entire card stack in-house, as well as Razorpay, which had to build a lot of the payment transaction stack. And, you know, they had different versions of it for different banks and so on. And so that's actually overall ecosystem good that is sort of left behind. So fintechs are ready to invest, and it's important enough on the bank side. What do you guys think?
So even startups around outside fintech, right? Everyone today wants to monetize and monetize quickly. They want to hit the market. They need model infra solutions. And I think that is one another why now. The most interesting thing which I feel is the biggest why now, right? So for fintech infra to flourish, I think open banking needs to flourish. For open banking to flourish, open data should be there. Now, if we look at each one of these, right? Open banking, I was going through a numerous surveys done globally, right? There's a shift in consumer trend wherein users are now more ready to sort of consume financial services at the point of consumption. So that sort of boosts open banking. Open data, and we'll cover it in more detail, but account aggregator could be the biggest push. And there are global trend lines to this as well. In Europe, I have seen that PSD2 guidelines, which is account aggregator equivalent in Europe, was one of the biggest triggers to sort of start the open banking flourish there. Even in US, if you trace back to the 1990s, right, when the accounting aggregation and data aggregation by some of the private players started, that's when people started talking about open banking. So I think we are here and now. One more interesting thing which came across when we were chatting with a bunch of bankers, I was in Mumbai a couple of weeks back, was that now it's not limited to only the large banks, right? There are SFBs, smaller banks, NBFCs, and everyone wants to be part of this value creation. They have seen some of the larger fintechs, larger banks hitting results, and they also want in on it. So that is another big why now.
No, completely agree. And I think the first wave of BaaS, they've done three things, right? One is, I think the first thing most important is functional tech. Can I launch a product? It might take time, but can I get it out of the door? Second is just in terms of pay-as-you-go models, right? You don't have to put in that few million dollars into the tech, make a pay-as-you-go model, set up the agreement, and then sort of get the product out rolling so that it's a win-win partnership. And the third is just around the frameworks of the partnership and who does what, risk, compliance, a bunch of those things, as you said, probably with a little bit of mistake, but they figured it out. So all these three put together have laid that par for the course or the basic hygiene on which now fintechs and banks operate. And that sort of brings me to the next question. Are we seeing the making of BaaS 2.0?
So we definitely think so. And we want to play a role in creating that ecosystem. let's just split it up into a couple of things. So first is actually the core banking system. And there, things have been slower to change. And I was maybe with some naivety and frustration, I was asking some CIOs and CDOs, chief digital officers, why aren't you guys changing? I mean, you guys are supposed to be the champions of tech. Why aren't you changing this core bank infrastructure very quickly? And they gave me an answer, and that's when I realized how naive I was. It was essentially that this is stuff that, you know, affects so many people's lives, and the systemic risk is so high that there has to be a significant upside in changing this. And there is, what they are seeing is a possibility of immediate downside and not enough upside. And so they're like, why should we make this decision? And just for context, one of them was telling me that, you know, if our system is down for an hour, that's it. We are a top four bank, and this would just bring the system down, and RBI would be here in minutes. And so when I think of it from that decision-making point of view, there's no upside in them making this decision unless it is 10x better.
And one of the founders once told me touching the CBS is like an open heart surgery.
Yeah.
So
While the patient is wide awake. and that's exactly that. So the core banking system, that's one. And the second is a lot of the product companies are not approaching that problem with a solutions mindset. And people will need to move from a product mindset to a solutions mindset, especially in this space. And there's this wariness with SaaS founders that they are perceived as a services company, but I think you will have to become a solutions company as well as a product company. So that's one part, which is the core banking system. But the second part, which is moving very quickly, is because of all of these open protocols that are happening, like Anand alluded to, which is, you know, Oaken, account aggregator, then there's co-lending, CBDC, ONDC. There's a bunch of these open protocol systems that are happening, borrowing from some of the architecture of UPI and so on. But in each of these, just like the rise of UPI created a whole bunch of companies, I think that's what's going to happen with each of these open protocols, which are then going to go into not just sort of workflow, which is sort of very easy for a tech system to build a SaaS product around, but also defining those business models as well. So both of which I think is very exciting for each of those spaces. So I think we are going to see a lot of point solutions which happen around these open protocols. And then once you have that point solution and it works, then you can build a big company around it.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I think the bar is also higher. Now you're coming and seeing a lot more companies which have a nuanced GTM, which start with a very specific product. You know, there's a very core where somebody is starting with a card stack, somebody is just starting with the LMS, LOS, somebody is looking at co-lending stack, and we've met a bunch of companies, and we've also seen from our portfolio that, you know, the way, for example, OneCards looks at rewards, you need a very nuanced thinking around how the tech stack behind that works, how Jupiter is thinking about, for example, lending, how some of our other early stage companies are thinking about launching their products. One of them is in wealth. So yeah, I think there is an acute pain point in each of these sub-solutions where you want people to come up with 10x products.
And just on that, like, I think I was chatting with Anurag of OneCard on this, and he said if today I had to start a company, it would be in bank tech. And that actually gave us a lot of confidence that we are spending time in the right place.
Which actually happened globally also. So Marqeta was planning to start as a prepaid card company, but then they saw the profit pools is higher in infra and they moved. Plaid planned to start as a PFM company, and then they eventually ended up being data providers and become one of the biggest companies in fintech infra. Some of the biggest tailwinds also are that in recent times, right, we have always been talking that fintechs wants to do this, tech companies want to do this. One big change I'm seeing is that the BIN providers, right, the FIs, they also are now more interested than ever. Why? Because they are seeing steep rise in their digital distribution of financial products. And they understand that with time, the share will only go up. So they are trying to spend more and more and build their digital distribution capabilities. Even on the CBS bit, right? While that has been true for a long time,
I can see some early signs of this changing. I was speaking to some of the bankers and they were saying that now they are realizing that for small ticket lending and real-time lending, right, they would have to go back and do that one big change, right, upgrade their CBS so as to not miss the explosion in personal lending. So yeah, those are the tailwinds that gets me excited.
So Vikram, you alluded to AA, UPI, OKEN, India being a largely digital public goods economy, right? Whereas in the US, you can set up private rails. Much of it is monetized because it's also, you know, set up either one-to-one or a private protocol. Now, a lot of founders say that is desh mein highway bhi ban chuka hai, toll booth bhi laga diya hai, toll ka rate bhi fix kar diya hai. So do you see that as a main moon, half glass half empty, glass full empty?
I think I can't think of any fintech founder and or fintech investor who will classify it as a bane. And honestly, I wouldn't be here if not for the public rails that have been built, because every one of our companies today runs on those public rails. Using your analogy, right, highway ban gaya, toll ban gaya, but that usually increases the GDP of the economy, right? Because you've actually built those core infrastructure very quickly. And I think that's the way to think about it. That yes, the rails have been built. What that means is that you can actually build a much larger, in the real world case, industrial GDP. In this case, you can build much larger fintech GDP because you're able to access a large set of users immediately and very quickly. So yes, you have to be much more thoughtful. So it is about building that solution and that industry. But largely, this is something which is a great thing. When I say you have to be more thoughtful, what I mean is that pick something which is potentially classified as a niche, but the forward trend line is very clear. And depending on where you are, you could take a bet on OKEN, you could take a bet on AA, but build the best 10x point solution on that. And then very quickly start offering other things which help the ecosystem players build products on top of it.
Yeah. Even Indian Rails on some of the emerging infra tech, right, CBDCs, I see that they are also doing a wonderful job, right? RBI's concept note on CBDC was one of the best white papers I've seen on blockchain. So yeah, I also think that it's a big boom. So moving on, Vikram. So one of the biggest questions, right, which everyone's keep asking in these infra singular businesses is that how do you make money, right? First, do you see it as a fintech or a SaaS? And India mein SaaS mein log paise dete hain nahi, right? And you have been investing and you have backed so many SaaS startups as well. So what's your point of view?
Yeah, I think this is one of those things that held us back. And I realized that it's a red herring. When you look at the banks and NBFCs, and you know, we've been privileged to back a few, they actually spend a lot on tech. It goes into IT services companies. They are buying a lot of tech globally. So I think it's a red herring because the actual data doesn't bear it out. The largest clients in India for the likes of TCS, Infosys, and so on will be the banks. So the data actually is not true that they don't spend on tech. Second, the question is, what is your model and what is your business model? Is it a SaaS business model? Is it a fixed licensing type business model? And when I say SaaS business model, there's an access for growth. In a fixed fee business model, it's a large licensed project-based model. Sometimes it's just a T&M, time and money model. And then there are transactions models. One of the things that I think we have to be very thoughtful about is are you really a transactions model? What we've heard from the banks, and yes, it is also convenient for them to say it, but they are essentially saying, why should we be paying you a transactions fee if you are not bringing us new revenue? If you are bringing new revenue, and they have a lot of co-branded cards and things like that, and you know, big partnerships, for example, like One Card or Razorpay, where it is all new revenue, and then there is new value add that they have done on the technology, as well as adding the new merchant, as well as the sales system, as well as the customer service, then they actually command a large transaction fee or large share of the transaction fee. But if you're actually just building tech and there are multiple users of tech and there are multiple dimensions on which those users are using tech, that's actually a SaaS model. So there is a, I mean, depending on who you are, but there is a monthly recurring revenue that you're paying. And then after that, there is some access for growth. And that access for growth might be number of users within the bank. It could be number of customers that they are calling. It could be API calls. So think in a more nuanced manner about what is that access for growth. And if you're not really adding new users, I would think really carefully about just saying, oh, we have a transaction processing model and a share of transaction fee.
So, Anand, I think I agree with what Vikram is saying, and that's a good test for founders, right? I think you need to ask yourself whether it's a BIPS model, it's a SaaS fee model, time and money model, and it's important to set the precedence upfront. If you actually think you're adding so much value and you want to grow with the client, ultimately, what's the best part of a SaaS business? Your client grows, or a transaction business, your client grows and you grow with them. So setting that precedence is important if you are building a transaction-based business. And on your question on fintech versus SaaS, I think the revenue cohorts can look very similar to SaaS or even better than SaaS, right? You keep retaining a lot of your revenue. You start with one product, get into multiple products, the transaction flow, the TPV, GMV, that keeps growing. All these are good signs of it being a healthy bank tech business.
Yeah. And the data also supports it, right? We tried going back and figuring out is what's the top-down revenue pool, right? How much banks are spending. And the number is whooping $7-8 billion. It's 3.5% of revenue. In US, it would be 12 to 13%. China would be at 4 to 5%. So there is definitely a revenue pool to be made. And I agree with Vikram that it's been a red earring. Moving on, Anish, we have been speaking about fintech infra, right? Are there any spaces that you are excited about that you want to invest in? And how do you go about selecting these, right? What's the framework that you follow?
No, so I think it's simple. As he said, find the gold rush and set up a stall next to it. So, you know, if I just think about it, what are the spaces today which founders are building in or we are excited about, right? Explosion of credit cards. You've seen Marqeta set an example globally. A bunch of them in India were doing it. M2P Zeta were helping you launch a card. Short ticket, contextual consumer credit exploring. Seen a bunch of unicorns globally. A few of the companies we meet are looking to build in that space. There's an uptick in securitization and co-lending volumes post the dip.
I think let's just stay on that first thing, right? But broadly, it is one explosion of consumer credit where we just see 200 plus million Indians getting access to some kind of, you know, short-term credit line, and it has to come about. And I think today's systems at the bank are not geared towards that kind of transaction concurrency hitting their system. So somebody has to build a system which actually talks to the fintechs or talks to the external partners as well as talks to the bank.
Yeah, and the variety of products, what works for the first 50 million will not work up to 200 million, will not work up to 400 million. You have amortization, bullet payments, just the variety of credit products which have come out and the innovation you've seen on the product side. All of it has to be supported by the tech stack or the infra at the back end to be able to configure and offer this seamlessly. So completely agree.
Just to bring that to life, at the back end, the core banking system is a simple system of credits and debits. And then there is the product that the banks love is loans, there's EMI, there's a simple way of calculating interest. Whereas all of these short-term products will have very different ways of repayment, collection, the way they are calculating interest, all of that will change. So there has to be almost a new transaction layer, which is translating the back end into the front end and vice versa.
Yeah. And on the B2B side, there has been an uptick in, the wholesale lending equivalent on the co-lending side, as well as on the securitization volume side. We've seen a few players who are going after that space. To say it's a boring space. Not many people think about it. Much of it is actually seen by us. It happens at...
So give a sense of scale. What is the overall balance sheet at play?
So before COVID, we were at DA plus PTC plus securitization was around 1.75.
You'll have to spell out these things. DA. Yeah.
So direct assignment plus securitization plus co-lending. All these three are various forms of risk sharing or risk transfer between banks and NBFCs. That was around 1.75 lakh crores. And that's expected to hit 2.5 lakh crores this year, next year. So this is massive scale.
And this is core to the way the bank system works, right? And this is core to how, as a financial system, RBI is driving financial penetration. So this is sort of as aligned with the overall system as it gets.
Yeah, and it enables NBFCs and banks to work on their strengths. So NBFCs are very good at distribution. Banks are very good capital providers and the balance sheet guys. So how do they come together and kind of transfer and share this risk? So very interesting space. We've met a bunch of players. I think that's promising. And the last one would be cross-border payments. We've discussed about this time and again. You know, we've had global examples of Airwallex or Rapid or Niyam, much closer to home, that have created value. This infra of enabling merchants and platforms and, you know, SME exporters to accept global payments is a big pain point among all the people we speak to. And I think in the next 10 years, we're going to see a lot of disruption in this space.
Yeah. And there also, in such a small space, there are subspaces, right? Some people are trying to attack it through aggregation. There is a whole set of universe of blockchain-based companies which are trying to build cases around CBDCs. So that's an exciting space. And we are watching out. If you are building something in that space, do hit us up.
The only thing that I would add is, you know, we also spend a lot of time in the enterprise SaaS space, you know, investing in a bunch of pure software companies going global. And I think the cadence and, you know, what founders are measuring in these startups is very different from a consumer startup. And I think the people building in this bank tech space or BaaS space have to take a lot of learnings from those SaaS guys and say, hey, initially, what are we looking for? Initially, what we're looking for is a large set of users who are adopting very quickly, and then monitoring those cohorts of usage, and then figuring out how many of those cohorts actually convert into the revenue, and then figuring out how is your expansion and churn looking. And just being very clear about that this is the kind of business that they are trying to build. So I think there's a lot of learnings in enterprise SaaS. In fact, I was at SaaS Pumi this year, and I was happy to see a bunch of fintech startups there. I think SaaS Pumi is a great place for the fintech startups to come and learn.
Good. So what are the, you know, the thing, the question with SaaS is when you land, then you expand. So what are the adjacencies? How do you think about where do I start my business and where do I finally end up? What all can I expand in?
Yeah. So I think you start with a wedge into the company. In this case, either it's a bank or it's a fintech or it's an NBFC. And in the SaaS parlance, they call it insertion point into the stack. But I prefer to think of it as a wedge. And you have a thin wedge, and think of it as something very sharp that can get you in. So it's usually a point solution where you're solving a acute pain point. And it might be something very small. It might be, you know, like what's coming top of mind is it could be signatures. It could be KYC. So it could be something which is a very thin point solution which gets you in. And then after that, you are making sure it is getting into, that point solution is getting into the primary workflow of the company. It could be a lending first workflow. It could be payments, whatever is that workflow that you're solving, so that on every one of the transactions, which is a lending transaction or it is a credit card transaction, you're in that flow. And once you're there and you're a part of every API call, every large entry, I think you will discover what are the other full solutions and product suite that you can build around. Yeah. But I think it's very important to get to that point solution. The second, I would take that point solution to multiple orgs at the same time. One of the things that we have seen is some companies get in with a point solution, but then they realize, hey, this client is really big. And then they end up customizing. And so then you do run the risk of becoming a services shop for that bank partner or that fintech that you're working with. But I would take that point solution to multiple clients and customers. And that then helps you say, okay, this is a pattern that's emerging across. And then you start building and customizing.
And after that, right, I feel after you have actually cracked that point solution and figured that it's working, right, what we have seen is that you can go down three paths. Either you know that your buyer is now impressed and he likes the solution, he trusts you, and you start building more products for the same buyers. That is one. Second is you figure that solution is exportable. You figure out geographies where the same solution with a little bit of tailoring, you can sell to those clients. You go abroad and export it. And the third is that you go after vertical expansion, right? either you figure that you can actually go and build fintech or other products on that, or maybe go back end and capture more share of the value.
And what are the skill sets that we look for on or are needed to build a bank tech play?
Skill sets, tech, of course. And, you know, in most other fintech areas, we actually have over-indexed on fin versus tech.
And in this, do you think it's tech over fin that's more important?
I think so. Because you'll have to build scaled systems where, you know, both the scale, reliability, security and compliance are so important. I think some of those problems can only be solved by people who are very tech first. I think the other thing is, how do you navigate this selling into, let's say, a bank? And a bank is a pretty complex entity where the buyer is different from the person who is involved in making the purchase decision is different from the user. And so to bring it live, security and compliance, the CISOs have a big role in getting a software approved or not. So you have to understand that you're going to have to navigate this system and stakeholder management, and therefore your sales and your overall GTM has to take into account some of this.
Yeah. So I think it needs to be both, right? All the stuff that you mentioned on tech, and also regulation is a big part of it, right? Offering tech, and one is offering the whole regulation stack, right? And sometimes it's not evident, but it comes with the fintech infra tech, most of the businesses. So you should have that skill in your team to navigate the regulations and do things the right way. So yeah, those are the two things, API.
Do you have to be from Chennai?
It helps.
And is there a minimum cutoff age?
Yeah.
40 plus?
I think the reason Anish is asking those questions is we have seen, right, that being, well, because Chennai had this incident, a very high incident of NBFCs and some of the small finance banks and so on, and they were sort of co-developing, co-designing some of these products together. And so we've seen a bunch of these companies come out of there. And the gray hair does give some appreciation of the complexity of a bank's processes, which I just sort of stated before. So it definitely helps, and it's something that's important. I think the larger thing is, you know, we were doing this conversation with one of the top four bank CEOs, and I asked him, how does this work? What do you look for in a partner like this? And he said, the conversation needs to be a win-win conversation. And a lot of the times when people are coming in, it's a win-lose conversation where you're saying, I'll help you do this, but then you lose on something else, and you're sort of taking like a pie and you're just sort of dividing it, and then it's a tug of war. And by the way, you're not going to win a tug of war against a bank. So figuring out how do you actually craft this win-win, which expands the pie, I think is a skill.
Got it. So the last thing I want to cover is global expansion. Do you think there's enough time in India? And we've discussed some of the spends around that. And is going global imminent? And if yes, where?
If global is part of your time, I think you should do it from day zero. Gone are the days when you said you would get your first five clients from India and then you would actually go global and the next step and so on. And this is a learning for us from the enterprise SaaS space. And you can see all experienced founders in the enterprise SaaS space build global companies from the get-go. And so if you think that time is an issue, I would be building global. Having said that, I actually think the TAM in India is massive, and the forward trend line on that TAM is even more so. So pick a trend line which you think is going to extend from the first 50 million accounts to the next 100 million to the next 200 million. And if you pick that trend line, I think you can build a large company just in India.
Yeah, totally agree with Vivek, right? So I see there are two markets, right? Either you can build for India and that TAM is expanding. And TAM at least won't be an issue in times to come. But the second approach, right, of going global also makes a lot of sense, right? We're doing some data digging top down. There would be 20 plus fintech infra unicorns in the US, total market cap of around $150 billion. Even if you take out Stripe and Rapid, it would be around $60-70 billion. So the profit pools to capture globally is huge. right? And even when I set aside the numbers, right, and actually look at the impact, right, it's very big, right? So, Plaid helped Varo sort of move their existing bank accounts. So for Varo to succeed, it was an important thing that people can migrate their bank accounts. Plaid enabled that, right? DriveWealth helped create the fractional US share investing market, right? Which also sort of translated to India. And then I can keep giving examples, right? Marketa enabled Uber Eats and some of the other Doordash to start offering prepaid card products, right? It could be argued, right? If not for these fintech infra companies, would these consumer companies would have it on their top five priorities to launch FS? Maybe, maybe not. So while India is a large market, global trend continues.
And I think we have two things which many countries don't. One is a large pool of qualified engineers, very strong tech talent, which kind of helps build best-in-class global products. And second thing is working with Indian banks. They are probably one of the hardest customers to sell to. We have probably some of the most tightest regulations, obviously in the best interest of the consumers. And if you're able to build a product, ship it to them in the realm of regulatory, in the regime, and then your product is probably fit for a lot of other geographies. There might be some tweaks, contextual. You might have to set up an entity there. There might be some flows which are different. The systems might be different. But largely, the product, I think, will be robust enough to be shipped across.
And to that point, you know, in this ecosystem, in the fintech ecosystem, made in India is a huge plus. Because you have been able to make and deliver at scale, I think every other emerging market for sure is adopting tech which is made in India. And of course, NPCI and UPI has done a phenomenal job where every country wants that. And so there is a halo of having built fintech systems in India, which will actually spur adoption in global markets.
Yeah. No, I think wonderful discussion. It reminds me of Ashmo's quote, boring danda hai, but boring danda mein paisa banta hai. So it's one of those businesses, high gross margin, probably takes a little bit of time to build and get off the ground, but just keep reaping rewards after you scale. We've been actively looking to invest in bank tech and BaaS companies. Please hit us up if you're thinking of this space. We've done the State of the Fintech Union report last year, where we cover some of this on how the fintech ecosystem in India is looking to scale over the next 5 to 10 years and how we all can play an active part in that. Happy to brainstorm with entrepreneurs looking to ideate or just looking to jam with us for a session.
Thanks.